life itself. One person can make a difference, and he made a difference for me. And I just hope he would be proud of this now. But I hope he would.
Ava DuVernay, director of Selma. It's been nominated for an Oscar for Best Film. Special thanks to our team in New York, Julie Crosby, David Prude, Sam Alkoff, Mike Burkhunt, Hugh Grant, Mike DeFilippo, and Becca Staley, some of whom stayed overnight in our studios because of the snowstorm. And here in Utah, it's Sundance, Renee Feltz, John Hamilton, Steve Martinez, Amy Littlefield, Elizabeth Press, Hani Massoud, Dennis Moynihan, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Brenda Murad, and Chuck Skurich. From Park City TV, I'm Amy Goodman.
And you are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kbu.fm. The time is 4:59. Stay tuned for the Tuesday evening news coming up after these messages.
Do you worry that corporate power is totally out of control? Tune into the KBOO Evening News every Tuesday evening at 5 p.m. beginning August 5th to hear the new weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. I'll be sharing stories about communities that are rising up against corporate control and passing laws that exercise their right to govern themselves. That's every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News beginning August 5th. Don't miss it.
Tune in Tuesday night at 6 p.m. to Out Loud, KBOO's queer culture radio show.
Out Loud celebrates and serves the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, questioning, and allied communities.
Out Loud features interviews with local and national community groups, authors, musical talent, and anyone from the queer community.
Connect with us online at kboo.fm/outloud. Tune in Tuesday at 6 p.m. on KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an oil spill in Washington State last November went unreported for a month.
Regulators in Japan have approved a plan to release contaminated water into the Pacific.
And the Dropkick Murphys literally hate Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 27th, 2015. I'm Nicole Weinstock.
And I'm Doug McVeigh. A new report from McClatchy News Agency has found that an oil spill in Washington last November went unreported because of gaps between state agencies. The oil spilled from a railroad tank car at BP's Cherry Point refinery last November, but key agencies were not notified about it for at least a month. According to reports reviewed by McClatchy, when the tank car arrived on November 5th at the refinery near Ferndale, rail inspectors found oil stains on its sides and wheels. A closer inspection revealed an open valve and a missing plug. The car was around 1,600 gallons short. But neither the railroad nor the third-party company that unloaded the oil at the terminal could determine where the missing oil had been spilled. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Matt Krogh of Forest Ethics.
A report has come out in McClatchy about the failure of state agencies to report on an oil spill that took place last November. Can you fill our listeners in a little bit?
Sure. What we have going on is, as I think most of your listeners know, a massive rise in oil trains coming to the Pacific Northwest. And one of the great untold stories nationally, you know, if you live near a terminal, like there are a couple in and around Portland, there's a proposal in Vancouver, you know what's going on. You know, you've seen the trains coming in and the rest of that. But the reality is that most of the communities in America don't really know what's going on. And there's about 25 million folks who live within a mile of the trains who are impacted by these kinds of spills. And so what's happened is a rail car arrived to the British Petroleum refinery up in near Ferndale, Washington, where they have recently constructed a rail loop. It's been operating for about a year. And that rail loop is designed to receive 1 to 1.5 mile long unit trains. So it's about 100 cars, all of them oil cars. And one of the cars arrived missing over 1,200 gallons of fuel. And so far, we've seen a lot of finger-pointing. Burlington Northern did not report the issue. British Petroleum, BP, did not report the issue until about a month later when the mandatory monthly reports of Bakken crude being shipped around the country finally was filed by Burlington Northern. And apparently, we just don't know where the oil went.
Has there been an investigation of this oil spill?
You know, there's no investigation so far, and there appears to be a real regulatory gap over who has oversight, who is required to report. And now, if we were talking an oil spill in freshwater or marine water, there would be a clear chain of command, of response, who was going to actually be responsible for identifying the problem and the cleanup. But with this circumstance that we have now with rail, we're talking about a largely unregulated industry that we've seen massive growth, right? We've seen over 4,000% growth in the last 5 years, from about 10,000 rail cars a year to over 400,000 rail cars a year in 2013, and growing since. But nobody seems to really have the responsibility, and I haven't seen any indication that they're trying to find a missing 1,200 gallons of oil.
Shouldn't it be the Washington State Department of Ecology that follows up on oil spills inland?
Sure. And the Washington State Department of Ecology does have responsibility for investigating quite a lot of this. However, they really don't have the funding. And our funding mechanisms in the state of Washington have been largely around the ways that we have traditionally received oil, which means by tanker or by the what's called a Puget Sound pipeline, which is a small spur or smaller spur from the Kinder Morgan pipeline that comes down from British Columbia. So they're tuned, they have people and investigators for pipeline issues and for vessels. But this oil by rail, it's really only happened in the last 2 years. You know, we've always gotten the oil by a few tank cars here, a few tank cars there. But the construction of new rail loops at Washington's refineries and the expansion of global partners down there in Portland has meant that we see these giant trains coming in, a vast increase in risk, a vast increase in the amount of oil, but no funding for it, or no funding for ecology and for inspections. So when we talk about tankers, there's a barrel tax right now. I think it's a nickel a barrel. I can't remember exactly how much. That helps fund the oil spill response. When we talk about oil coming in by train, there isn't such a tax at all. And so that's part of what's happening in the Washington State Legislature this year. We expect it to be a fight, but we're trying to find funding for response. But at this point, anything that's prevention, whether it's new ways of making sure these tank cars stay closed, which this one apparently did not, making sure the trains stay on the tracks, there's nothing out there to actually try to prevent the accidents. We're just looking at a nominal amount of increase of money to try to clean up.
Is the solution really to fund more of the cleanup efforts, or should there be an effort to reduce the amount of oil being shipped by train in the state?
You know, that's really a great question, but I think there's a fairly clear answer. And that is, you know, the state of Washington, the state of Oregon, the U.S. nationally has actually been reducing the amount of fuel we use. And when we talk about these new facilities, in large part, we're talking about increasing capacity for crude coming in that we aren't using. And some of that crude gets exported to California, and lots of it is refined and shipped to other states. And so one of the real questions, you know, is when we look at who we are as a region, we're passing legislation, all sorts of clean energy solutions. We're building stuff. We have, you know, some of the lowest carbon footprint in the country on a state-by-state basis out here on the West Coast. So, you know, no, I would say that for our purposes, there's no reason to say, yeah, bring some more oil through, bring more pipelines or trains or whatever through. It exposes us to risk. You know, if you're talking about the usual and accustomed fishing areas along the Columbia River that tribes been accessing for thousands of years, whether you're talking about, you know, recreational fishers, commercial fishers, people using the rivers, the areas around these rail, there's a lot of risk associated with it and almost no benefit.
I've been speaking with Matt Krog from Forest Ethics in Washington, talking about how state and local officials were not notified of an oil spill at a BP Cherry Point refinery up in Washington State back in November. That has just come out now today about the lack of oversight of this BP Cherry Point refinery rail loop. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
A $900,000 lawsuit has been filed on behalf of a 10-year-old foster child who was mauled in the face after being placed in a foster home with dogs, despite his known fear of animals. The boy, who was identified by the initials DR, was moved to the Gresham foster home of Lillian Yun in February of last year. Yun's residence doubled as a Doberman Pinscher rescue. DR was bitten by one of the dogs shortly after his move and viciously attacked on July 10th of 2014. This incident and his subsequent hospitalization finally resulted in his removal from the home. Hillsborough attorney Matthew Kehoe is representing DR in court. He is suing the Oregon Department of Human Services in addition to the Catholic Community Services of Western Washington, which DHS contracted to place DR in Yun's home. According to the suit, both entities were at fault for failing to intervene on behalf of DR. Not only was the boy's fear of dogs known and reiterated by his counselor, but Yun had a history of contact with animal services for dog bite incidents.
Washington state legislators have introduced bills to repeal that state's death penalty. To find out more, we spoke with Danielle Fulfs of the Washington Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Danielle, Washington state legislature, two different measures have been introduced to repeal the death penalty there. Could you tell us something about those?
Sure. So yesterday, two bills were introduced. One was with the Washington State House, which was bill number 1739, and then one was also introduced in the Senate, which was bill 5639. So those are both bills to repeal the death penalty in Washington State, and both have Republican and Democratic sponsors. So they're both bipartisan bills, which is great, something that we're really excited about, to have more support on both sides of the aisle.
Now, Washington has had a moratorium on the death penalty for the last year, imposed by the governor. Is that correct?
Yes. That was introduced last February by Governor Jay Inslee. It just means that while he's in office, he will not sign any death warrants. So anyone who's currently on our death row will not be executed while Jay Inslee's in office.
How many people are there currently?
We currently have 9 people on our death row.
Now, so as you said, it's a bipartisan. These are both bipartisan measures. Are they basically the same measure, just introduced, one on the House, one on the Senate, or are there differences?
They're the same measure that's being introduced. So, you know, the ultimate goal is that we will have support from both sides, which has happened, which is really, really great. We're excited about that. But we're looking at, you know, the issue of cost with the death penalty in Washington. In addition to those 9 people that are currently on death row, we have 3 cases going on in Seattle, which is King County. So those 3 cases have been going on, one since 2007 and the other since 2009, and they're only just now reaching the trial stage. They both started, or 2 of the 3 started last week. Those have already cost King County taxpayers $15 million, in addition to other costs that will be incurred after conviction, or, you know, if they're not found guilty, then we will have the appeals process and everything like that, in addition to then housing them in the correctional facilities. So the costs are really astronomical, and they really take away from other initiatives and things that are really important to the state of Washington.
Now, the ACLU of Washington, if I remember correctly, issued a report earlier this month talking about the difference in costs between death penalty and non-death penalty cases. Could you speak about that for a moment?
Sure. It was actually a report that was conducted by Seattle University. And the report showed, you know, they looked back at the cost of the death penalty over time, and what they found is that by and large, death penalty cases cost at least $1 million more than non-death penalty cases. So that means that when we pursue death, we are accruing an added cost by doing that. There's a lot more that goes into a death penalty case. And it also takes a lot longer. Jury selection generally takes about 30 days instead of 1 to 2 days. You know, there are a lot of requirements that need to be met, and that increases the cost.
And now these measures, going back to the bills, getting rid of the death penalty, what would it be replaced by?
It would be replaced by life in prison without the possibility of parole. And it would also add the requirement that those convicted would need to work to make restitution to the victims' families.
And how do you feel about prospects for this legislation moving forward?
I think that we have more support this year than we have had, and I think that with Governor Inslee's moratorium, you know, it's really highlighted the conversation about the cost, and I commend him for urging, you know, constituents and lawmakers to have a conversation about the death penalty, and I think that that's being had this legislative session, you know, hopefully more than we've seen in the past. Of course, you know, there's the process of getting the bill to the floor, which is now our focus, but I think that, you know, people are willing to have the discussion and to look at the facts and figures, and so we're looking forward to seeing how far we can go with this.
If people want to find out more about the legislation and about the coalition, where would they go?
Our website is abolishdeathpenalty.org. That's a place where you can find a lot of information about the death penalty in Washington and our organization. The bills can also be found on the Washington State Legislature on their website. So that's available, but we will post them to our website, which again is abolishdeathpenalty.org.
Danielle Foltz, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
And now we turn to the weekly commentary from Paul Cienfuegos for Community Rights and Dismantling Corporate Rule, produced weekly for the Tuesday Evening News.
Greetings, you're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. There is a huge political divide between the Democrat Party's leadership and its local voters. There is a huge political divide between the Republican Party's leadership and its local voters. In a nutshell, the divide can be summed up like this. Voters from across the political spectrum oppose global corporate trade treaties like NAFTA and the current outrage called Trans-Pacific Partnership. Voters from across the political spectrum oppose bank bailouts using public funds. Voters from across the political spectrum oppose the corporate takeover of our entire society. On the other hand, the vast majority of our congresspeople, our senators, and certainly our president support corporate trade treaties, support the bank bailouts, and generally support the corporate takeover of the country. It doesn't matter which of the two mainstream parties they're from. Republican and Democrat elected leaders stand together against the will of the American people and for corporate power. The latest example is Obama pushing for fast-track authority for the Trans-Pacific so-called partnership agreement. If we had an honest mass media in this country, this fact would be obvious to everybody, but our media is now corporate too. In other words, on the issue of corporate power, it's not a left versus right political struggle, although that's what the 1% would like all of us to believe. The real political struggle is between the ruling elite and the rest of us, regardless of our party affiliation. Tragically, most activists tend to either ignore or not understand this fact. So liberal advocacy groups endlessly attack conservative politicians, and conservative advocacy groups endlessly attack liberal politicians. It's great for fundraising, but it doesn't do much to build a movement of we the people taking our country back from corporate rule. What left versus right bashing does accomplish quite effectively is something that the 1% has been doing since there was a 1%, a strategy called divide and conquer. From the American Revolution till the end of slavery, the ruling elite quite successfully kept their white indentured servants fearful of the African people who they had enslaved, in order that the two groups not realize how similar were their situations and thus join together to end their oppressive conditions. The same thing happened with the various waves of immigrants throughout the early 20th century,
ensuring that each wave would distrust the next wave to ensure that they would not organize together and demand a better life for all working people. The 1% has referred to we the people for 200 years now as the rabble and the mob, so it's pretty obvious what they think of us. Let's not forget, the 99% isn't just the left or just the right. It's almost the entire population of this country. So of course we're a threat, especially if we can stop being on autopilot with this divide and conquer crap, and instead start mobilizing to create a real participatory democracy across class, across race, and across political party boundaries. 5 years ago this month, in the Citizens United decision, the Supreme Court decided to further expand the so-called constitutional rights that they had been granting to corporations ever since 1819, 195 years ago. The Citizens United decision made it even easier for large corporations to donate massive amounts of money to influence elections and to hide where the money was coming from. 75% of Republican voters and 86% of Democrat voters were opposed to this Supreme Court decision. So you would hope that voters from both parties would have immediately thrown off their conceptual shackles and started organizing across party lines to end corporate rule once and for all. But that is not what happened. Why? Because divide and conquer still works. The two political party machines just kept up their constant attacks on each other, and the voters from both so-called sides stayed obedient to the propaganda from their respective party leaderships. And of course, this story was not reported on the evening news because our news institutions are now also almost entirely owned by five giant corporations. One poll after another continues to confirm this fact that is hidden in plain sight, that most Americans oppose corporate power. Here's a recent example. In 2014, Democracy Corps asked Americans what they thought about the Supreme Court. It turns out that an overwhelming majority of Democrats, Republicans, and independent voters disliked the court's performance, believing that judges are influenced more by their own personal beliefs and political leanings than by a strict legal analysis. Perhaps even more remarkably, a similar cross-partisan consensus exists to suggest a wide range of reforms for our nation's highest court. So even in this time of intense political polarization, there's broad cross-partisan consensus on these issues. Two recent decisions on campaign finance have only served to intensify Americans' dissatisfaction with the court. An overwhelming majority of Americans disagree with the Citizens United ruling, including Democrats, independents, and Republicans, and among every demographic group, while Americans of nearly every stripe believe the recent McCutcheon ruling will make our political system more corrupt, again with broad consensus across Democrats, independents, and Republicans. Perhaps most intriguingly, the survey found overwhelming approval for a series of seven reforms that would make the Supreme Court a more transparent and accountable body, with large cross-partisan majorities supporting most proposals. The most popular reform would require Supreme Court justices to adhere to the U.S. Judicial Code of Conduct, which of course most of us thought they already had to do. But it turns out the judges of the Supreme Court are the only judges who are not required to disclose who is buying them flights on private airplanes or paying them speaking fees or giving them gifts. Abolishing lifetime appointments in favor of setting term limits also proved popular with the public, including a specific limit of 18 years or a single term of office. Television and audio broadcasts of the court's proceedings were supported by a supermajority of all Americans. The least popular reform, that the justices post a summary of their financial disclosures online, was still supported by 59% of all Americans. You can read more about this poll by going to democracycorps.com and typing Supreme Court in the search box. What would it take for Republicans and Democrats and Greens and Libertarians to work together on the urgent issue of corporate power, to move outside of our comfort zones and realize how much we have in common? We have no time to lose. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KABU Evening News and a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can follow me on Twitter at cnfuegospaul. You can sign up for my newsletter at paulcnfuegos.com. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Out Loud at 6, welcoming the Gay and Lesbian Archives of the Pacific Northwest and author Wendy Colley. Since 1994, the Gay and Lesbian Archives of the Pacific Northwest has been working to discover and publicize the history of sexual minorities in the Pacific Northwest. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. And the weather. Tonight, a 40% chance of rain or drizzle. Cloudy, with a low around 46. Tomorrow, a chance of rain or drizzle before 10 a.m. Cloudy, with a high near 58. Today in history, in 1944, the city of Leningrad was liberated from Germany after 600,000 were killed. The quote of the day is from Henry A. Wallace, speaking about fascists, also in 1944. They demand free enterprise, but are the spokesman for monopoly and vested interest. Their final objective, toward which all their deceit is directed, is to capture political power so that, using the power of the state and the power of the market simultaneously, they may keep the common man in eternal subjection.
It's 5:26, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Well now, here's some unexpected news. It comes from what purports to be an official document of the National Republican Party. And wow, the policy positions it contains show that the party leaders really are serious about coming to their senses and rejecting the plutocratic extremism and far-right wackiness that has stained their recent presidential, congressional, and gubernatorial campaigns. Right at the top, this 18-page manifesto proclaims that, quote, "Our government was created by the people for all the people, and it must serve no less a purpose. All the people." Forget last year's ridiculous pontifications by Wall Street billionaires dividing America into virtuous creators, like themselves, and worthless moochers, like you and me. This document abounds with commitments to the common good. Quote, "America does not prosper," it proudly proclaims on page 3, "unless all Americans prosper, unless all Americans brown right Democrats." How's this for a complete turnaround? How's this? Labor is the United States. Labor, men and women who with their minds, their hearts and hands, who create the wealth that is shared in this country, they are shared in this country. Holy co-brothers, share the wealth, co-brothers, and share the wealth. The protection of the right of workers to organize and to the right of workers to bargain collectively is the firm and permanent policy of the Republican Party. Your heart out of Scott Walker and each other labor-bashing GOP governor, other labor-bashing document also supports the Postal Service, the United Nations, Postal Equal Rights for Women, expanding our national parks, vigorous enforcement of antitrust laws, and raising the minimum wage. New enlightenment in the grand old party. Hallelujah. This is Jim Hightower saying, can all this be true? Yes, except it's not new. This document is the Republican Party platform of 1956.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Former prisoner of war, U.S. Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl may soon face desertion charges under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. The soldier disappeared from his Afghanistan military post in 2009 and spent 5 years in Taliban captivity.
He was released in May of last year as part of a controversial prisoner swap that released five Taliban leaders from Guantanamo Bay. Retired Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer claimed during an interview with Fox News' Bill O'Reilly that the validity of the charges had been confirmed to him by two separate but unnamed military officials. The report has yet to be confirmed or denied by the U.S. Department of Defense. According to Schaefer, Bergdahl's attorney was presented with a charge sheet that lists which articles of the UCMJ were violated. The key charge is desertion. The Obama administration was criticized for the trade after fellow soldiers accused Bergdahl of abandoning his unit and placing his comrades in danger as they searched for him. Bergdahl remained on payroll and was meritoriously promoted to sergeant during his 5 years spent in captivity. He is currently stationed at Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio.
Community activists across the country rallied today outside payday lending storefronts to encourage protection for consumers against short-term, high-interest loans. According to the group organizing the protest, these loans trap millions of Americans in a cycle of debt. Events featured local community advocates in hazmat suits taping off toxic payday loan stores, which they said were, quote, deadly, unquote, to communities. The activists called for stronger protections against devastating loans from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The Day of Action was coordinated by Americans for Payday Lending Reform, a project of the Racial and Economic Justice Group National People's Action. Across the country, 35 states authorized payday lending in some form. While some states and cities have worked to pass local laws capping interest rates, federal laws still largely allow payday lenders to prey on vulnerable communities and benefit from borrowers' financial hardship. Each year, payday lenders make more than $10 billion in fees by trapping an estimated 12 million consumers in a cycle of debt, with annual interest rates near 400%. Payday lenders have been known to use tactics like threats, harassment, and intimidation in order to push customers to take out more loans.
We've been listening to a wee bit of the song I'm Shipping Up to Boston by the Dropkick Murphys. The band are just a little bit upset with Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. It turns out that he used that song, without permission, at his speech on Saturday at the Iowa Freedom Summit. In response, the band tweeted to Walker this: "Please stop using our music in any way. We literally hate you. Love, Dropkick Murphys." This is not the first time the group's music was borrowed by a Republican. In 2012, the Wisconsin Assembly Speaker Jeff Fitzgerald used this same music on his Facebook page. Their reply at the time was, "The stupidity and irony of this is laughable. A Wisconsin Republican and crony of anti-union Governor Scott Walker using a Dropkick Murphys song as an intro is like a white supremacist coming out to gangsta rap."
Japanese regulators have approved a plan to release partially decontaminated water directly into the Pacific Ocean from the Fukushima nuclear power plant. The Fukushima nuclear power plant, located in eastern Japan, suffered multiple reactor meltdowns that are still out of control and leaking extremely radioactive water directly into the Pacific Ocean. To keep the reactors cool, thousands of tons of water are pumped daily into the basement containment area of the reactors, where the fuel cores are believed to be located following the reactor meltdowns. More than 400,000 tons of contaminated water is flowing every day directly into the Pacific Ocean, where testing has shown radioactive levels to be thousands of times over the legal limit. The new plan, approved by the Japanese government, attempts to treat the radioactive water before pumping it directly into the Pacific Ocean. The treatment system removes up to 62 different types of radionuclides,
But critics argue that the system is unsafe, as more than 1,000 different radioactive isotopes are contained in the wastewater. The new treatment system will remove less than 10% of the radionuclides present. Several types of iodine, cesium, xenon, and krypton will not be removed. When fully functional, the system will treat up to 750 tons of water per day. Since its installation over 2 years ago, the treatment system has yet to decontaminate 250,000 tons of water, about half the daily amount flowing into the Pacific Ocean.
In other Fukushima-related news, the youth obesity rate in Fukushima province has exploded over the last few years to double the national rate. Scientific studies of the Chernobyl nuclear accident has shown that prolonged exposure to moderate doses of radiation increases secretions of amelanotropine. Increases in amelanotropine secretions lead to metabolism changes and measurable increases in obesity levels, especially among the youth. The large increase in the youth obesity rate follows the large increase in childhood thyroid cancer rates for Fukushima. Childhood cancer rates have risen from 2.5 cases of thyroid cancer per half million children to over 110 per half million over the last several years.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. As thousands of Delta flight attendants wait for the National Mediation Board to schedule a union election, Delta Airlines has reported another record profit. Delta made $4.5 billion in 2014. That's $2 billion more than 2013 profits, which was also a record. The National Mediation Board is expected to schedule an election that could result in IAM union representation for 20,000 Delta flight attendants. On the day Delta flight attendants filed their union cards for the election earlier this month, Delta flight attendant Cynthia Allen said that a lot of work went into collecting the union cards.
For the past 2 years, we've been actively collecting cards on our layovers and sitting visibility in our tables in Detroit.
Drew Yates was very happy to see the union cards filed.
This is only just the beginning. Now the real work begins. We now must continue the momentum to make this a reality.
Here's International Association of Machinists President Tom Buffenbarger speaking to some of the flight attendants on the day that those union cards were filed.
It's a special day. I think you'll remember it for the rest of your lives, and only one day better. And that's the day that Richard Anderson signs that contract.
As Delta makes record profits, fired Delta baggage handler Kip Hedges is still fighting for reinstatement. A Minnesota employment ruling means he can get unemployment compensation, but he has yet to hear a final word on his appeal within Delta to be reinstated. Hedges was a union activist fighting for $15 in a union at Delta when he was fired. Hedges says workers struggling for unions at Delta are winning.
All of us right here, right now, we're winning. It's been a long time since we've been able to say that. The flight attendants, 20,000 of them, filed for a union election at Delta to get union representation with the machine.
Happen? Go.
280 boy soldiers were released from the rebel Cobra faction of the South Sudan Democratic Army this morning. They were received by the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, in a village in the eastern portion of the country. Over the next few weeks, another 2,700 children will be released in batches. These children represent just one quarter of the estimated 12,000 that have been used as soldiers by armed groups in South Sudan over the past year. Many of the children, who range in age from 11 to 17, have never been to school. UNICEF shared one child's plea, "Please hurry up with the schools or our minds will go back to Cobra." According to UNICEF, the recently released children were not forcefully recruited by Cobra, but rather joined to defend their families and community and the Merle ethnic group from which the rebel faction arose. UNICEF is providing a number of resources to address the children's basic necessities and psychological needs as they reintegrate into their communities. The cost of these services is about $2,300 per child for 2 years of support. As such, UNICEF is appealing to donors for assistance.
Thailand joins other nations in the effort to minimize drone interference with commercial air traffic and the general public. The Transport Ministry of Thailand is moving to require a license for all drone flights. The ministry has enlisted the Civil Aviation Department to draft a proposal. At present, it would threaten any individual or business caught in violation of the would-be law with a year in prison or a fine equivalent to $1,200. The proposal also seeks to limit drone airtime to 1 hour and drone travel to a zone of 15 to 150 meters from the ground. It may also stipulate a size and weight limit for these unmanned aerial vehicles. Transport Minister and Thai Air Force Commander-in-Chief Prajin Juntong says the proposal would be sent to the Cabinet for approval and, pending approval, put into action as early as February.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Tuesday, January 27, 2015. Israeli troops injured 3 civilians during invasions targeting West Bank communities and opened fire at Palestinian farmlands in Gaza. The stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Three young Palestinian men have been injured by Israeli rubber-coated metal bullets on Tuesday while many suffered the effects of tear gas inhalation near the northern entrance of Haram town north of occupied Jerusalem. The three were shot earlier on Tuesday morning while dozens of residents were protesting the army closure of the main entrance of their town with concrete blocks. All wounded Palestinians received treatment by local medics and their injuries did not require hospitalization. Protesters hurled stones, empty bottles, and used fireworks during clashes with the soldiers who fired gas bombs, concussion grenades, and rubber-coated metal bullets. In related news, the Jenin Office of the Palestinian Prisoner Society, PPS, has reported that Israeli soldiers have kidnapped 3 Palestinians near the Salem Israeli military roadblock in the northern part of the West Bank. The PPS said that the 3 Palestinians were among a group of residents who gathered near the roadblock to welcome 2 political prisoners who were released from an Israeli prison after being held for 18 months. Earlier on Tuesday, Israeli soldiers kidnapped 3 Palestinians in Silwan town in occupied East Jerusalem. Elsewhere, Israeli forces opened fire at Palestinian agricultural lands across the borders between Israel and the Gaza Strip, witnesses said on Tuesday. Several Israeli military vehicles stationed near the gate of the border fence east of Khan Yunis opened fire several times towards Palestinian fields on the other side of the border. No injuries has been reported. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was a Tuesday, January 27th, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Doug McVeigh, Charlotte Guline, Nicole Weinstock, and Jim Thompson. Our engineer is Sequoina Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives.
Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Paul Roland hosts Wednesday Talk Radio, local, national, and international issues. We invite your calls at 503-231-8187. At 9, we hear another panel from the Teach-In on Techno-Utopianism and the Fate of the Earth. The speakers are Clive Hamilton on Playing God with Climate, Geoengineering New Skies, Pat Mooney on Nanotechnology and the New Earth, and Debbie Barker on GMOs and Corporate Techno-Food. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio, with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on The Recovery Zone, Perry Gruber discusses Copiosis, an alternative socioeconomic system he founded in 2013. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And now stay tuned for the news in depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Hello, welcome back. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge.